Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Sharif Bassioni, professor emeritus from DePaul University in Chicago, Laith Al-Sud, an Islamic studies lecturer, and Yasser Tabara, former executive director of the Council on American and Islamic Relations. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the offices of the Museum of Broadcast Communications on Chicago's Near North Side, and our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's toll-free, 1-800-723-8289. Our email address is btb@museum.tv, and our website is www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, for the next 2 hours, we will continue our focus of discussion on Egypt and the historic events that have taken place in that country over the last 18 days. While President Obama declared the world and the United States was witnessing history unfold, uncertainty still looms large over Egypt tonight. Longtime President Hosni Mubarak ceded power on Friday, turning over the command of the military to Hassan Tawani. But now, to usher in this new era of Egyptian democracy, the people are resorting to everything undemocratic, at least thus far. Today, the Egyptian military suspended the constitution, dissolved parliament, putting the country under direct military control with promised elections 6 months away. The Supreme Council of the Armed Forces said they will draft constitutional amendments to guide the democratic transition, and they will put those amendments before the people. Joining us tonight is Sharif Bassioni, one of our guests and one of the country's and one of the world's really foremost authorities on Egyptian political affairs. And we start with you, Professor. Nice to have you with us, back with us.
Thanks,
here a couple
Bruce.
Of weeks ago. You were a big hit then, and Egypt has kept you and everybody else on the world stage. You wrote recently that President Mubarak will continue to pull strings behind the scenes through Tetwani, and that the process of succession will most likely follow the legal steps laid out by the Egyptian constitution. Yet here today, given the events of today, how is the transition going to come off, in your view, given the events of today?
Well, the I think it's important to look a little bit at what happened in the last few days. The popular revolution, the power of the people, so to speak, was so overwhelming. On last Friday, for example, 4 million people were in the streets. And I think the military came to the obvious conclusion. The police had dissolved. Most of the police officers just simply packed and went home. The only thing was left was the army. The army was not about to shoot on peaceful demonstrators. And there were 4 million people in the streets. So that's a very powerful message, which had been going on for 14 years. So how did they convince Mubarak to resign, so to speak of? You know, my guess is, knowing Mubarak and knowing how stubborn he is and the relationship between him and General Tantawi, the Minister of Defense, is Tantawi probably said, you know, you've done enough, you've served your country, you know, this is too much aggravation, go to your house in Sharm el-Sheikh in the Sinai, and, you know, we'll talk on the phone, whatever you have anything to say, give me a call, I'll put it in practice. So that being the case, they established then, you know, the power of this structure. Now, so that the people know, your audience, is this is equivalent to the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staffs. But instead of being 5 generals, there are 15 generals. So it's an enlarged commission.
Yasser Tabara also joins us. He was born in Damascus, Syria, raised in the United States, and is a United States citizen. Yasser, as you look at the events of the last several days, what is it that you think is the most compelling news to come out of Egypt?
Well, obviously, the President Mubarak stepping down, and after giving a pretty disheartening speech to the millions of Egyptians watching and the millions in the world watching, it just showed that you know, he was not in touch with reality, basically.
Now, as an American, how do you grade the way that President Obama has dealt with the last 18 days?
Well, I've always had some criticisms as to how slow we moved towards basically finally being on board with, again, reality, the reality on the ground. And I've said before on this show that it was disappointing to hear the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and President Obama's statements to be extremely cautious and very careful from the very beginning. I mean, after all, this is a dictatorship that has been supported by the United States, by our governments over the past 30 years. And I guess it was understandable for them not to have taken an equivocal position on it, although very clearly not in touch with reality and what was happening on the ground, and the fact that the people were asking for things that were completely in line with our democratic values here in the United States.
Laith El-Soud also joins us. He was born in Baghdad and came to the United States many years ago, also a United States citizen since for the last 20 years, Islamic studies lecturer at DePaul University. What is the religious overtones of what Americans in the world are seeing in Egypt?
You know, that's actually a very important question because as of recently, a lot of discussion has emerged regarding the CIA's analysis of the Ikhwan, or the Muslim Brotherhood, as they are known, in which they were described as a secular movement. And quickly, some figures on the right criticized the intelligence under President Obama, saying, look how wrong they got it, describing the Muslim Brotherhood. And our intelligence agencies actually backed off and, quote-unquote, corrected themselves by saying they were wrong by describing the Brotherhood as secular. But, in fact, what I would want to say is that Egypt will continue to be a secular country. All organizations in Egypt, whether they have some sort of religious affiliation or not, are not theocratic. There are no theocratic movements in Egypt, including the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood themselves are constituted of laymen. They're doctors, they're lawyers, they're engineers, and this is what comprises their membership. Unlike in Iran, you had a revolutionary movement. In fact, the Iranian Revolution was complex, just as the Egyptian Revolution was, or is. But the outcome of the Iranian Revolution was theocratic because you had a clerical establishment that was pushing forward a certain interpretation of Islam. In the case of Egypt, even when we look at groups that associate themselves with Islam politically, they are still constituted of laymen. They are not clerics. So the fear and the boogeyman of Egypt turning into some sort of theocracy is not there. I mean, structurally, it's just simply not there.
Given the historic relationship that Egypt has had with Israel, and given the mood of those in the streets that now represent the new leadership, that whoever evolves as the leader has got to respond to, is there any likelihood that Egypt will move in a direction against its association with the State of Israel? That's the question. We do have to pause for a break. I want to give everybody a chance to respond to that. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. From coast to coast and border to border, I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago tonight for the full 2 hours this evening, talking about the historic events in Egypt, what they mean for the world, what they mean for the United States, and how soon will we see some significant changes in creating a democracy in Israel. Back shortly from Chicago. From Boston to Austin, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. We're talking about Egypt and its future. And the question before the break was that the newfound power that the people are exercising in the streets, is that likely to change the historic relationship between Israel and Egypt, in your view, Professor Bassioni?
Well, in the first place, it will not. But this is not a done deal yet. The people do not have the power yet. We do not know if it'll wind up in the hands of the people. What happened is Mubarak resigned, a military group took over, which is the Superior Military Command Council, consists of 15 generals, like the chiefs of staff in the U.S., they took over.
Who get a lot of money, $2 billion a year from the United States.
Actually, it's about $1.3 million. But, you know, people don't really realize this, but, you know, there's a lot of pork in there. The 1.3 million
pork in a military budget?
Yes, going to Egypt. You know, that equipment is mostly unused or old equipment or surplus equipment that the DOD has. It gives it to Egypt on a basic price tag. It then gets the credit for 1.3 million, and then it goes to the Treasury and gets an equivalent credit to buy new toys. So what the Egyptians are getting, in large part, are sometimes new stuff like F-16s, but in many cases, it's Abrams tanks, it's equipment the U.S. doesn't use, it's rifles.
No, but my point is it wrong to believe then that the money that taxpayers have sent to Egypt, and it's about $2 billion a year since 1979, Has that not created a sense of, if not allegiance, friendship with the American military? Many Egyptians were trained in the United States, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. But I'm just.
So we shouldn't fear that there's a pocket of military folks within the Egyptian military that may be anti-U.S.
The military is totally supportive of the U.S., okay. But that's in the leadership. You know. The military also consists of about 456,000 conscripts, and these are people who come in for a 3-year military service from the people. Where their sympathies lie, I don't know, but nothing that will happen will affect the peace treaty with Israel, period.
Yeah, so you're weigh in on that piece, and then you want to elaborate on something else as well.
Sure. Actually, I wanted to talk about this issue about the relationship with Israel, between Egypt and Israel, and this dictatorship or not, Egypt is bound by international treaties, and one of these international treaties was the one that was signed in Camp David between President Sadat and the Israeli government. It's very important to also distinguish between these historical, very, very important treaties and several other type of trade treaties or kind of less significant treaties. But the point that I wanted to make is that the people that have instigated the revolution and that have basically went through the streets of Cairo throughout Egypt and basically toppled the regime, the current regime, they are... And I've been following a lot of these interviews on Arab TV and several stations, and I've been following a lot of these people that are basically looked at and pointed to as leaders of this revolution. They're a very sophisticated group of people. I mean, they are people that have that are politically aware, that have an opinion on international relations, that have that have political positions on these issues. They've thought about these issues, thought through these issues, and so whatever the power, you know, end up laying in whoever's hands, whether it's going to be these revolutionaries, directly or other proxies or other councils, there will be an attitude and a culture of respect to international human international treaties that Egypt had basically put on itself. Now there might be popular pressure to reverse some other types of treaties. For example, there have been a number of treaties that have been exposed since the revolution that basically involved unfair trade. For example, selling some natural resources, Egyptian natural gas, to Israel that were pennies on the dollar. And so those are the types of treaties that I think would be reevaluated.
What I'm hearing you say is that at the core of the organization of this revolution are politically astute young people, not necessarily just people that are rushing to the street and want change for change's sake.
Well, it's evident
that they clearly have a vision of what they want the future to be, and part of that obviously is a releasing of the repression that collectively they felt for many, many years.
Well, I mean, ironically, the clearer the vision, the less the ideology, and this was clearly a non-ideological movement and revolution, which facilitated a clear vision of what they wanted. What they wanted was accountability, and by affirming and gaining some accountability, you have more efficiency and more prosperity in a society. I don't want to leave, though, this Israel discussion, because I want to approach it from a different perspective. My esteemed colleagues have a legal background and are experts in international law, and they are absolutely right when they say that Egypt will be bound by its international treaties and will continue to be bound by those treaties. But I have more of a philosophical background, and I want to approach this philosophically. In terms of political theory, peace endures more between democracies than between democracies and dictatorships. I mean, this is something that's well established in political theory. So the narrative of fear is somewhat problematic to me. I would think that as a ostensibly democratic society, Israel would be looking forward to seeing democracy in Egypt. So the notion of fear is somewhat problematic. My question is this. If Israel feels that its survival is predicated on the maintenance of two dozen dictatorships throughout the Arab world, I think that this is a question you need to pose to the Israelis as opposed to the Egyptians. Okay. Furthermore, the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel.
But what's tied to what you just said also, which was the origin of my question to Sri Passione, and that is, if the U.S. dollar has attempted to buy friends, many of whom have turned out to be despots.
Yeah.
And the world is now or their populations are turning against those despots. Is there and obviously Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. Of foreign aid, with Egypt being second. Then how is that money going to be? Is the power of the United States to pull strings or to muscle their money? Is it going to pay off in a situation that apparently now may be a happy ending to a story? I'm talking about what's happening. Maybe.
Well, behind
revolution without bloodshed, without anti-American acrimony and things that we've apparently seen thus far.
Behind your question are a lot of the esoteric assumptions being made in media that no one wants to talk about. The assumption is, can we really trust these Egyptians to be democratic and rule themselves in a world where there's a certain balance of power? And as Yasser pointed out just a moment ago, the Egyptians are quite astute. They're intelligent people. They know what the world is like. They know what the balance of power in the world is. And anyone who wants to pursue their own interests pursues their own interests in reality. They don't pursue their own interests in ideology. It's often ideology that obfuscates reality, and people make mistakes in terms of policy. So if what you're asking me is, are the Egyptians going to continue to have a relationship with the United States that's cordial, and Israel's very important to the United States in this regard, my answer is yes. However, we cannot excuse what has been Israeli policy in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. I mean, this affects Egyptians. Egyptians are Arabs. They do have a sense of solidarity with the Palestinians. And part of the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel is predicated on a peace process between Israel and the Palestinians. And this peace process has been a no-go.
Now, you said something that I want to get everybody's reaction to, and then we're going to take some telephone calls. You talked about that the revolution is not ideological. Some would say that maybe what we're watching now is obviously a burgeoning population of young people frustrated with their economic condition, no bright future before them. They have been sat on basically by an old man with a brutal dictatorship in many cases. And they have this new thing called Twitter and the internet and revolution. So could one, and again, if it's not ideological, as you said, could we see a continuing of revolutions throughout the Middle East? Again, not necessarily based on ideology, but based on technology, youthful frustration, and a core element of that frustration, as you said, Yasser, are bright, college-educated people. I mean, they're not necessarily even from the downtrodden society or population within those countries, but they're young, they're bright, they've got their Twitter, and they now can see what the combination of those three things can start. And they've already seen it in Tunisia. The protesters are in the streets today in Yemen. They saw, everybody is watching on worldwide television what happens in Egypt. Is this a spark that, frankly, cannot be stopped?
One of the core groups that basically behind the Egyptian revolution is called the April 6th movement or April 6th group. And this is a group of young men and women who basically have been active since April 6th, 2008.
You continue that, because we're going to a break right now, the April 6th movement, we want to talk more about it. We do have telephone callers on the line, 1-800-723-8289. Again, this is a historic time in the history of the world, folks. Sunday night, we've got three great guests here in Chicago. Take advantage of their intellect and join us. 1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border, live tonight from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Boise, Idaho to Boardman, Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's great terrestrial radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. Phone lines open at 1-800-723-8289. Joining us this evening is Sharif Bassioni. He is a distinguished research professor of law emeritus at DePaul University. Also was born in Cairo, came to the United States in 1962. Started teaching at DePaul in 1964, became a citizen in 1965, was once a political prisoner in his home country of Egypt, and was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in the field of international criminal justice back in 1999, author of 32 books, 47 hundreds of articles, and again, joining us this evening also, coincidentally, are a couple of his students over the years. Yasser Tabara is here. He was born in Chicago but grew up in Damascus, Syria. He moved to the United States in 1993, where he completed his undergraduate studies in political science at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He is also a filmmaker and also a board member of the Arab American Bar Association and CARE. That's the Chicago chapter, which is concerned with U.S. Islamic studies and relations. And also joining us this evening is Laith Al-Saad. He was born in Baghdad, Iraq, came to the United States. What year did you came here? What year?
No, 1980.
1980, and became a citizen a few years later. And you are a lecturer of Islamic studies at DePaul University. And also, once upon a time, you were a writer for Al Jazeera. And Al Jazeera, let's just take a moment, since I'm the president of a broadcast museum. The role of Al Jazeera in this revolution and in the revolutions to come. Let's take a few moments and talk about that, and then I want to come back and have you finish your history lesson on the April 6th movement.
Yes, Al Jazeera is being hailed in the Arab world right now as a total hero, actually, an unbiased broadcast company that's basically reached out to millions of Arab viewers when the airwaves of Egypt and Egyptian public TV and official television stations were basically spewing propaganda that is absolutely disconnected and delusional. And
would it be wrong to say that Al Jazeera then maybe is going the other way and is becoming the preacher and the cheerleader for the people in the streets against any leadership or establishment?
I cannot speak on behalf of Al Jazeera. I think they, from my assessment, it seems to be a pretty neutral news source. I was comparing it to the broadcast over the 14 days of the revolution that we saw in our homes through satellite dish TV of official Egyptian news channels, which basically focused on, to give you a small example, when there are millions on the streets and hundreds of thousands in Tahrir Square, you would hear the report of few hundred or few thousand people on the streets on these TV stations, and you would hear basically a constant call to by some people that were later on proved to have been paid to basically discourage people from going out and participate in the revolution.
But also they tried to shut. I mean, they shut down Al Jazeera for a while in the early part of this revolution.
Yeah, you'd wonder why,
right?
Exactly.
And also they knocked down the internet. Can you again? It's a former employer of yours, but what historic role are they playing in everything that's evolving in that part of the world over the last, 6 months?
Well, let me address two things. The first thing is what do they do? And considering the fact that everyone criticizes Al Jazeera, they're doing something right. I mean, whether you're on the right or you're the left, everyone, there's on the extreme ends, people criticize Al Jazeera, which tells me that they're getting something right in the middle. Now, in terms of what role that they're playing, I think that Yasser is quite right. They couldn't be playing a more significant role. They're providing objective free access to information in a part of the world in which despotism is predicated on suppressing access to information. And, of course, information is quite liberating. So Al Jazeera is doing a very professional job. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's relentless. It's rigorous. I mean, their bureaus get bombed. Their bureaus get burned down by people who are sponsored by various governments. They've been bombed by us a couple times, quite frankly. And they're relentless. They continue to do their work. So I applaud them, even though I'm only a former employee of Al Jazeera.
Sure. They've been doing that for the past 15 years.
Yeah. Sharif, I want to have you weigh in on this. The extent to which Twitter and the internet are being given a major spotlight by the instant analysis of what happened in Egypt, is that correct? The role of technology, the role of communication of this generation and a younger generation, is that really the key to why this happened and why it happened so quickly, and maybe even peacefully?
Well, tactically, it was indispensable to the type of happening that occurred. But I think that if it were not in context, if it were not for the fact that there were 30 years of abuses by the Mubarak regime alone, 60 years of abuses by Mubarak, Sadat, and Nasser before that, arbitrary arrest and detention. I mean, when you think that the constant prison population of people who are political prisons were 15,000. I mean, until now, people don't know that there's an estimated 5,000 to 7,000 disappeared persons who are in prison dungeons in Egypt without any form of legal process. Thousands of people have been consistently tortured. 90% of the wealth of the country unabashedly taken by 200 families supported by the Mubarak government. You know, all of that gets to a point where an explosion has to occur. So the Twitter and the Facebook and the means of communication were only the tactic that was able to bring the people out in different places at different times to do what they needed to do.
Folks, we have a lot of callers on the line. Let's bring them into right now. And let's go to Sylvia, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS Radio in Chicago. Go ahead.
Well, my question would be, after this revolution is over or settled, and whether it's a year or 6 months or whatever, will anything really be any different for 50% of the population that's women? Are they going to be liberated?
Well, first of all, notice how many women were part of this revolution. How many women were in Tahrir Square and elsewhere? Cutting across, women with hijab, women without hijab, women completely covered. In fact, most people don't know, but the principal coordinator of all of the demonstrations for these days since January 25 is a single mother, a woman aged 36, who went to an apartment overlooking Tahrir Square with about 10 other people and her 10-year-old daughter. And they spent all of that time living in that office, and she was coordinating it. So imagine a revolution in an Arab Muslim world coordinated by a single mother.
Jack and KLBJ in Austin, Texas. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I wanted to mention on the Twitter, Facebook aspect. In my experience, I spent 10 months in Iraq, and the internet does play a major part in allowing an individual to communicate. Within countries like Tunisia, Yemen and Egypt, it definitely plays a major part, very similar to late 1700s, early 1800s taverns did in revolutions in the old world. I think we're going to start seeing, with the expansion of these kinds of sites, a larger increase in the lower, younger population with more education being able to communicate. You get enough smart people together who see something wrong, they can come up with an answer for it, and hopefully the result will be a lot more of these glorious revolutions versus bloody revolutions but definitely we're going to see a lot of revolutions occurring in the Middle East.
Yasser, do you agree with that?
Well, I think whether it's Facebook, Twitter, Al Jazeera, whatever you want to, the internet, I think it's very important for us to make this very crucial distinction. These are all tools that are basically have been put and employed to good use by these very astute young men and women, and who have their own motivations, who have their own reasons to actually go ahead and conduct this revolution. And going back to your question before the break, you asked about whether this is going to spread to the region and to other Arab countries. And we are seeing it, as the caller was referencing Yemen, for example, and I was starting to talk about the April 6th movement. And in fact, actually, a lot of the April 6th movement, core members are women, are young women. And basically, they have been organizing and have been thinking about this revolution and have been basically studying exactly the best ways to go about it for the past few years. I mean, this has been since maybe 2008. And so it's not really as spontaneous as we think it is. I mean, there is planning. There is, again, these are astute people that are students of history, and they employed these tools, this internet, the Facebook, Twitter. Al Jazeera informed them and helped them and helped inform people that, the general Egyptian population about the reality on the ground and helped spread their messages. But it's important to make that distinction, I think, because there's a lot of credit that is being given to all sorts of different technical entities, but these distinctions are not being made.
Is there anyone in the Arab world at the moment who you think is trying to get ahead of this curve and maybe making some adjustments to what's been happening over the last 18 days?
Well, I mean, you've seen the...
There's been suggestions.
You've seen the King of Jordan yeah. change the cabinet. But, this is cosmetic change. He put in a former prime minister who was a former army general. He increased the pay of government people in order to placate them and satisfy them. I don't think these cookies and candies are going to last long. People are going to want more.
We've got calls coming in on the Muslim Brotherhood. We'll hear from them when we continue. 1-800-723-8029, live coast to coast. I'm Bruce Dumont on Sunday Night. From Rochester, New York to Rochester, Minnesota, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. Back to calls in just a moment. But again, we have been talking about what's been happening in Yemen, not only the last couple of days, but again, escalating today. Young protesters in that country squared off against security forces, and some marched on the presidential palace as a third day of demonstration sought to emulate the revolution in Egypt. The protests, organized largely by a way of text messages, were the largest yet by young Yemenis, 1,000 strong marching. It appeared to mark a rift with opposition groups who had organized previous demonstrations. The younger, more tech-savvy ones appear to be wanting things turned over a little bit quicker than perhaps at least the ones that were demonstrating last week. The initial demonstrations, a smaller group of young professors peeled off and marched toward the presidential palace, only to be violently repulsed by armed security forces, both uniformed and in plain clothes. Unlike the earlier protests in Yemen, which were largely organized and marked by color-coordinated clothing and signs, the spontaneity of today's younger demonstrations appeared to have more in common with the popular uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt, where opposition groups watched from the sidelines as leaderless revolts grew into revolutions. You talked earlier in the broadcast, Sharif, about that many as maybe as many as 4 million were in the streets. Because you have some connections, and obviously you're still talking to friends and neighbors and colleagues back in Egypt, what's happening with the people who are not in the streets? Are those who are not yet out in the streets, are they worried about the revolution? Are they worried about where it might go? They may be older. They may be more comfortable with the status quo. They may be more comfortable or even supporters of Mubarak. Is this an older generation of millions and millions of people who are frightened about what the rest, or at least those many around the world, are seeing as a positive thing? Are they fearful?
The answer is no, but this is obviously not something that can be documented. Egypt's population is estimated to range between 81 and 84 million. 50% of it is under the age of 30. So we have about 40 million, 50% of the population, over the age of 30. But that means that the age group 30 to 50 is a large age group, particularly because, of course, the mortality rate in Egypt, the average age is 62. So you don't have too many older people who are afraid. Most people really share the goals of democracy and human rights and freedom. Most people in Egypt have been affected by the tyranny of the regime and by the corruption that has taken place. So I think there is truly a consensus for the direction in which Egypt should go to. There is a consensus against the regime, the Mubarak regime. It has to come to an end. Something new has to be, but it has to be orderly and democratic.
Let's go back to calls. James, listening to us in Austin, Texas on KLBJ. Go ahead.
Earlier in the program, I heard someone refer to the Muslim Brotherhood as characterize them as doctors and lawyers and caring members, you know, of the society there. And isn't this the same thing that we heard with the PLO and Hamas and Hezbollah? I really think that they're sponsors of terrorism. They're characterized as, you know, these caring people. But I think that in this situation that the Egyptian people should really be careful about the Muslim Brotherhood and not allowing them to, you know, have any kind of impact or, influence on the government as it's going to be formed here. So
well, let's think about that. Let's let Yasser stay on the line. Let's let Yasser Tabara respond, because he was the one that painted the picture of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Actually, it was Laith.
Okay, well, I'll let Laith go. Okay.
Yeah, well, I could respond to that. I didn't hear the question in there, but I can certainly respond to the statement. And once again, here's what's problematic. To lump the PLO, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Muslim Brotherhood all into one category is extremely problematic and patently false, if you want to, by lumping them into a category, say that they're the same thing. First, the PLO are an explicitly secular organization, or it was an explicitly secular organization when it engaged in the peace process with Israel and became essentially the Palestinian Authority. In the case of Hamas...
And by the way, is recognized by the United States and by Israel.
Yeah, precisely.
Israel is negotiating with them now.
Yeah, and in order to make a long story short, I don't need to provide a biography on each of these groups, but these groups cannot be any more different from one another. The only thing they have in common is they happen to come from a part of the world that we refer to as the Middle East. And if we're going to continue to just simply homogenize this whole part of the world, a very important part of the world, we will continue to have problems with our foreign policy and making sure that we maintain an efficient and effective foreign policy in that part of the world.
Let's go to Dave on WLS in Chicago. Go ahead, Dave. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. It's been rumored that Mr. Mubarak, either personally or his family, has accumulated a significant amount of assets. I've heard figures of up to $7 billion. I think $2 billion would be a more appropriate figure. Do you think that the new government, new people in the new government in Egypt will try to go after that money?
Could you give us a 30-second answer to that, Shereen?
30-second answer, yes, they have accumulated a substantial wealth. Nobody knows the exact amount. The two sons are quite likely to have anywhere between $1 and $2 billion. Switzerland has already undertaken steps towards seizing their assets, but the Mubarak family is not the only one that profited from it. There are so many people around the Mubarak family that has profited and has taken the money out of the country, and that is endangering the economy of the country. That's going to be the next crisis.
And we will talk about that, continue our discussion about that in the next hour of our broadcast. Sherif Bassioni is here, professor of law emeritus at DePaul University. Laith Al-Sud, he is an Islamic studies lecturer at DePaul University. And Yasser Tabara, former executive director of the Council on American and Islamic Relations, joins us as well. We're going to continue this discussion in the next hour. And also, there's an effort for a documentary. Yasser is going to trying to putting a documentary together about this historic time, and we'll talk a little bit about that in the next hour as well. 1-800-723-8029. More calls when we continue. But again, we're going to pause right now for network news and then be back on the other side with your calls in another full hour of Beyond the Beltway. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway this evening, featuring commentary by Sharif Bassioni, Distinguished Research Professor of Law Emeritus at DePaul University. Laith Al-Sud, he is an Islamic Studies lecturer, also from DePaul University, born in Baghdad, but a citizen of the United States. And Yasser Tabera joins us. He was born in Chicago, grew up in Damascus, and then came back to the United States, and he's been the former executive director of the Council on American and Islamic Studies. Our program lines open at 1-800-723-8029. That's 1-800-723-8029. Before we get back to our discussion and your calls at 1-800-723-8029, I do want to take a moment to talk about Project Yasser. You are involved in trying to work on a documentary about what is unfolding in Egypt. Can you, without revealing all of your secrets, what's the plan?
Well, the project's in an initial phase right now, and a group of us basically wanted to go on the ground in Egypt and document some of the things that are happening. We actually believe that what is going to happen in the next few weeks and months is actually more important than the monumentous events that happened over the past 14 days. We feel that this revolution was about a cultural change, about a paradigm shift, about moving a society from dictatorship and oppression and these very dark unfortunate values to democracy and to government accountability. And we are actually seeing a lot of these very mundane manifestations of people taking ownership of their streets, of their neighborhoods, young men and women clearing the streets without being paid and without anybody telling them to do so. Traffic being a lot more organized than it used to. People are just starting to feel excited about basically taking Egypt back, and we feel that is such an exciting thing to document, and that's what we intend to do.
I want to pick up on that and put it in the context of the Americans watching over the last 7 years, our attempt to urge democracy on the rest of the world and in the Middle East. And so we had the experiment in Afghanistan, and we've had the experiment in Iraq, and we've had the joy as Americans of seeing the people with the purple thumbs because they're so proud they'd never voted before to a country that unfortunately only sends about 50% of the people that care enough to vote in the United States. And so we see, for those who love freedom, allegedly, and who love democracy, allegedly, we're now seeing it on the third stage. We should put Tunisia in there, maybe on the fourth stage. We're watching it live on television, not in the context of a war, as we did in Afghanistan and in Iraq. We're seeing it in a more peaceful way. But we're seeing it with large. This is yet another revolution that we're watching on television. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about where that thirst or where that definition of democracy to a young, 30-something Egyptian who's in the streets, has been in the streets, moved to the streets by the repression of the country in which he lives and loves. Can you tell us a little bit more? And I want to start with you, Sharif, because you've got the most gray hair at the table. Can you tell us a little bit about that thirst? Can you describe it for us, for people that don't quite know what democracy is all about? I mean, are we hoping that they understand our definition of democracy, or will the definition of democracy in Egypt not look too much like what we expect it to look like?
You know, most Americans seldom project back to the founding period of our nation. Americans don't think of how it was when the Declaration of Independence was written. What is the turmoil that went through Americans to do that? What were the fears they had in facing the mighty Great Britain England, and then going through the War of Independence and what it was, what the extraordinary odds were. In a sense, if you want to understand Egypt, and for that matter, the rest of the Arab world, you've got to make that historic shift. You've got to think that this is their time of making their Declaration of Independence. This is their time of having their War of Independence. And yes, they have the same values and the same principles and the same hopes and the same expectations that our founding fathers had. And that is because, frankly, this is totally natural to human beings. You know, we are born free, as our Declaration of Independence says. We are all born free. We all have the feeling of being born free. We are all born with a certain dignity, divine dignity. And we don't want that dignity to be trampled by dictators and people who profit from it. We rebel because we are affirming our human dignity, our divine right to be equal and to stand up equally respected. That's what's happening throughout the entire Arab world. And the time will come when other Arab countries will rise to that challenge, will take to the streets, and will reclaim their dignity.
Laith, your response to the same question?
Well, I think the one thing we need to keep in mind is that liberty and democracy are not the same thing. And in fact, we find in our own political system a wonderful, productive tension between the pursuit of liberty or freedom and the pursuit of democracy. And I think that that tension will persist throughout political discussions in the Arab and Muslim world as well. You see people who sort of want the state out of their personal affairs, who want to pursue their religious life privately, who want to pursue business privately. And at the same time, you see people who may be on the other side of the political spectrum who want majority rule, who want there to be greater correspondence and commensurance between the population and the government. So I think that this tension, we have to be sophisticated and nuanced as people who've participated in democratic society for a long time. I mean, we have grown up and participated in this type of politics for decades, all of us here at this table. And we need to understand that the democratic process is a deliberative process of intellectual tensions. And so long as those tensions remain intellectual as opposed to physical, then I have a great deal of optimism for the Arab world. It's a bright part of the world. They're educated people. They have a great civilization and a great history. So I'm quite optimistic.
Yasser.
Democracy is not a monopoly to the West. It's not necessarily a Western concept. The Arab world, and as demonstrated by this revolution and as was demonstrated by Tunisia, is quite capable of pursuing it and hopefully implementing it. And I think that as someone who's worked in American-Islamic relations, if you will, over the past years, someone who had basically spoken on behalf of issues of civil rights of Muslims and Arabs, issues that basically fuel this whole wave of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim sentiment comes from this understanding that people in the Muslim world are just not equipped to basically handle these types of values, these types of self-government accountability values and self-governance. And I think that we will see over the months and years to come that is patently false. And I think that will be a fundamental shift of paradigm in the United States and the West in terms of viewing Islam in the Western world.
1-800-723-8289. These are very historic times. We thank you for joining us tonight. More calls and conversation when we roll on from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and Sharif Bassioni, I want to give you a chance to kind of comment on or a caution to some Americans who might be expecting this euphoria of the streets to even with elections 6 months away, that Egypt is a long way from being out of the woods.
Well, you know, one of the interesting characteristics about the American people is, one, we don't have historic memory. You know, we sort of forget history. The second is we're always accustomed to have instant solutions. You know, it's like adding a little bit of powder, put some water on it, stir it, and you have instant democracy or instant whatever it is. And the third is we frequently confuse democracy with elections. You know, we went in Cambodia and we spent $5 billion. We had elections. Nothing much happened. We went in Haiti, spent God knows how many billion dollars, had an election, walked out, said we had the election. Went in Iraq, went in Afghanistan, same thing. We are confusing all of that. Democracy is a long-term process. It requires building institutions, but it requires building a culture of democracy, which is part of educating the people. And that doesn't happen overnight.
I want to ask a follow-up question about American presidents. First of all, I want to go back to June of 2009 in Cairo. President Obama spoke to the Muslim world, and in his speech he attempted to lay the foundation for building bridges to the Muslim world. And he said, America and Islam are not exclusive and need not be in competition. Instead, they overlap and share common principles, principles of justice and progress, tolerance, and the dignity of all human beings. Okay, that's one president.
John Adams also said the same thing.
That's, okay, two presidents, one in Cairo saying that recently. Then let's put that in context to President Bush during his inauguration, second inauguration, in which he was speaking to the world and speaking about spreading democracy. His goal was to spread democracy. When presidents of the United States speak in those huge, broad, flowing terms, in speeches that generally are carried or at least reported around the world, does a speech like George Bush, does that have anything to do with what we're watching in Egypt right now? Is his cheerleading for democracy, is that part of what maybe we saw in Tunisia? Can anyone
draw that? George Bush,
I see some
eyebrows
being raised here. But
George Bush used the term freedom, not democracy. And I agree with him. Freedom is the first step of everything. And George Bush expressed the fundamental values of the American people, just as Obama expressed the fundamental values of the American people, just as many other presidents have. The problem is we seem to have a schizophrenia. We have those values at home, those values which we profess we believe in, but our foreign policy is all about military interest, strategic interest, economic interest, subjecting everything to the business world. These are two different approaches. America must have a single mind and a single word when it speaks to the rest of the world. It has to speak in terms of its fundamental values. It has to be on the sides of the angels that it believes in.
So then, let me ask you, Yasser, to get response to the same question. I want to get each of your responses.
Yes, I believe that Leith's perspective on this, being Iraqi and having studied this is very valuable. But really quickly, my position on this is that, of course, some of the things that George Bush had mentioned, and there was an article in New York Times today that was trying to link George Bush's rhetoric and discourse to what's been happening in the Arab world right now, which is I'm very, very skeptical about. But having said that, I think George Bush had said some things that basically some factually or correct things, and in terms of the Arab world needing to have an infusion of these democratic values. The mistake that he made is he thought that he can export these types of values on the backs of tanks and weapons by invading another sovereign society that basically did not invite him in to actually liberate themselves, and that sort of stark contrast stands in the minds of every Arab young person right now who is motivated by or moved by the Tunisians and the Egyptians and knows that democracy is something that has to come, or this thirst to democracy, as you were talking about earlier, has to come through an organic process from within and not exported from without.
Leith.
Well, I don't want to repeat what Yasser just said about democracy needing to be self-generative. But let me just ask the listeners and fellow Americans to think for a moment about this last decade. I mean, our adventures into the Arab and Muslim world were inaugurated in 2001 with the September 11th attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C. President Bush began to initiate a policy in which he wanted to spread democracy, and by spreading democracy, ameliorate tensions that he felt were causing terrorism. But what happened after the war in Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq in 2003? Terrorism actually went up, and we saw more violence directed against American soldiers throughout the world. We saw more violence directed against American allies throughout the world, and we saw the prestige and respect in which the United States is viewed in the Middle East go down, and go down significantly. And anyone who knows anything about that region and is honest will have to tell you that. So let me just bring up this image. Think about the statue of Saddam Hussein being torn down.
The one thing I will add to that, though, is in the mind of the American, we did not see an attack on the United States, on the domestic homeland, although there were a couple of close calls. Mm-hmm. So his initial, I think part of his initial rhetoric in going into the war was, you know, we're going to bring the war to them, meaning to the terrorists. We would rather fight them on the streets of Baghdad than fight them on the streets of Boston.
The problem is the terrorists were not in Baghdad.
Exactly. You know? Precisely.
So that was a mistake. But what you're saying...
I mistakes. Said Baghdad. Was, he didn't say Baghdad. Yeah. I'm just
no, but he did by what, invading Baghdad.
No, no. What,
by invading Baghdad.
There's
a
disconnect between the two. There was undoubtedly an enormous effort by the administration to shore up what we call homeland security, which is to ensure the protection of the United States.
Right.
We can see that every time we take a plane. That was long overdue, and it was done under the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. And credit has to be given to it because of that. But that doesn't mean that the Iraq operation or the Afghanistan operation were successful.
You were going to make a point because you were born in Baghdad. You're an American citizen, but finish your point.
Okay, so I'm going to contrast the fall of the statue of Saddam Hussein in April of 2003, and the sort of disastrous effects that invasion has had on our foreign policy over the last few years, and contrast it with the erection of a statue in Tahrir Square that's commemorating the inauguration of a new democratic order. And I will say this. I have to disagree with my colleague Yasser somewhat. I, too, was critical of the president and his response as a concerned citizen vis-a-vis Egypt. But as opposed to responses by President Reagan and President Clinton, who were in similar situations in both the Philippines and Indonesia, President Obama made a decision within a week, as opposed to President Reagan, who took about 3 years in the Philippines, and opposed to President Clinton, who took about a year and a half in Indonesia. And considering that being considered, it was actually quite quickly. And I think President Obama has done a service to this country and has elevated the legacy of the United States in that part of the world, and a very important part of the world, for our national interests. And the one last thing I want to say is,
can I ask you a quick follow-up?
Strategic interests and principles are not mutually exclusive. We need to keep that in mind.
Do you think, however, again, you gave praise to the president, but do you think he did a good job in basically sending the message that he was sending to the worldwide audience, that he was properly sending that message to the folks over at the State Department, who at sometimes were talking a different game? Joe Biden was talking. He was saying that Mubarak is not a dictator.
Who knows what Joe Biden's saying half the time? I mean, half the things that come out of Joe Biden.
But what I'm saying is there didn't seem to be a universal discipline to the message coming out of the United States.
Yeah, I think both the New York Times and Newsweek are reporting on the rift that was in the administration. And that you had people like Joe Biden, who is going on his usual, speaking whatever he came to his mind. But that basically Hillary Clinton and a few of the old guard, so to speak, of who were thinking exclusively in strategic terms and excluding any principled dimension to it, were saying, he's our ally, we have to stick with him. Otherwise, we're sending a signal to all of our other quote-unquote dictator allies that we're not going to stand with
them. Isn't it also the difference between, let's look back to from whence Barack Obama came. He put together a political revolution of his own. using a lot of the new technologies, reaching out to the same demographic generation that you described as going on in there. And frankly, he seemed to get what was going on much more so than Hillary Clinton, who was playing by an old songbook. And she's still playing playing by an old songbook.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
And I think
Add one thing to it, excuse me, is he also has promoted a younger team in the National Security Council, like the Deputy National Security Council Advisor, a fellow named McDonough, who is in his 30s. And so not only him, but the new White House staff is attuned to that type of modern, youthful, open thinking.
All right. On that note, we do have to pause before somebody, usually Yasser, is right in the middle of a point. We have to break, but we're going to break before we give them a chance to do that, and we have lots more callers on the line. I promise we'll go wall to wall with calls when we come back. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. Tonight, talking about Egypt, the future of Egypt, the future of the United States relations in that part of the world, and what are the next nations that we can look to where we think there's going to be significant change and people in the streets. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Sharif Bassioni is here. He's a distinguished research professor of law emeritus at DePaul University. In 1999, he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. He's written 32 books and hundreds of articles and is one of the leading experts on what has happened in Egypt. Has been a frequent guest on many programs for many decades. Was born in Cairo. He was imprisoned by President Nasser of Egypt at one point. Came here in 1962, joined DePaul in 64, became a United States citizen in 1965. Laith Al-Sud also joins us. He was born in Baghdad. He is an Islamic studies lecturer from DePaul University. And Yasser Tabara joins us. He is a former executive director of the Council on American and Islamic Relations, and he's preparing to do a documentary of the events of this historic time in Egypt. We have lots of callers on the line. Let's go to Jim, listening to us on WLS Radio in Chicago. Go ahead, Jim.
Earlier in the show, you gentlemen had mentioned about the ladies' participation in this April 13th group or whatever it is. And it's very interesting to me because, for example, there was a stat in Egypt before made it illegal. It was something like 95% of women suffered from genital mutilation. Now it's something like 85 or something. And as well as you know, is women can't drive and vote and things. So I don't quite get the affiliation of how women can be of power when they live in an oppressed society.
Well, but what you're talking about, if you're talking about the women in the street, are part of the group that wants to overthrow the repression in their country, repression that you have described.
Well, but the facts are wrong. First of all, there is no obligatory female mutilation in Egypt. It's a custom. It's a practice. The practice is estimated to be at about 20%. Of the population, so it's not 80 or 90%. Also remember that Egypt has about 10 to 15% Christian population. They do not have this particular practice. So that's not really at all an issue here.
And I'd also like to emphasize that it's limited to more rural areas and the uneducated and things like that. You're not going to find this as a common practice in Cairo or Alexandria and places of well-educated middle-class folks.
Sam in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Go ahead. Nice to hear from South Carolina tonight.
Yes, I've been listening to your show, and I think there seems to be a lot of propaganda and sugarcoating about the Islamic Brotherhood. To my knowledge, there's never been an Islamic nation that had a democracy. And to compare what's happening in Egypt to the U.S. revolution is just, it's insane, because any part of an Islamic revolution, there's going to be Sharia law. And whether they're layman or not, the Islamic Brotherhood do believe in Sharia law. They do believe in the spread of it. And it's total antithesis to what we believe in this country and everything that the revolution stood
for. Everybody wants to respond to what you've said. So you have described what is happening as an Islamic revolution. Everyone around the table this evening has discussed it as a Egyptian
secular
revolution. So there's a little bit difference there. But everybody, as you were speaking, they all want to respond to what you've said. We'll start with Leith.
I think you're raising an important point because it's pervasive in American political discourse. But if I can ask you a question, if I were to ask you whether the evangelical right and their participation in politics, does that constitute theocracy to you?
I'm sorry, would you repeat that, please?
Does the participation of the evangelical Christians in the United States who are informed, who are politically informed through their evangelism and their Christianity, do you consider that a threat to our secular order, and do you consider that theocratic politics?
No, I don't, because I believe it's very different from what you see in the Islamic nations.
Why?
I think the Christians here in the United States, I think to compare what you're seeing in some of the Islamic nations to what we have here is total insanity.
But why? Why is it different?
It's not serious to compare one to the other. Jihad, I don't think Christians are wanting to export jihad around the world.
No, the point that I think Leith was making is that in one particular case, you have true believers in Jesus Christ and the Christian faith. They have chosen to become very active in politics and to become an important political force in the Republican Party, and they attempt to use their power to change policies and to affect policies that affect, 300 plus million people. So if you will accept that as, I think, a political fact of life, Leith's point was a similar thing may be going on elsewhere with the religion is different, but the strategy of participating in politics and using as a foundation of your political beliefs, your religious beliefs, is that not similar?
With the elements that are in place in the Middle East, no, it's not similar. I think what we have the throwbacks in the Middle East believe that they want a second coming of the Crusades, except this time they want to have petrodollars and nuclear weapons on their side.
With all due respect, you're kind of all over the place. All right, the Muslim Brotherhood, and I'll say this as an expert in the region, as somebody who actually studies Islamist political movements in 20th century and 21st century in the 21st century Arab world. I am telling you, the Muslim Brotherhood is not constituted of clerics, and they do not possess religious authority. They are a society or an organization of laymen. They do not have the authority to excommunicate people. They do not have the authority to tell people what Islam is. They are simply people who are participating in Egyptian politics, who have views that are informed from their religious background. But in no way, they don't even possess the structure to overturn the secular nature of Egyptian government. These are the facts. These are the facts of the matter.
And I think there seems to be with this caller, and again, as Leith said, it's a pervasive public attitude for some reason. I think it's due to lack of education, lack of knowledge about these concepts. I mean, we hear these concepts, these words thrown around, Sharia, Jihad, Islamic Brother, and people just do not seem to know what these terms actually mean. I mean, I would like to even, at the risk of I don't know, maybe confusing some of these, some of these opinions that seem to be baseless, in my opinion. The Muslim Brotherhood itself is not a monolithic organization. There is a lot of nuance and a lot of difference of opinion between the older establishment of the Muslim Brotherhood and the younger establishment of the Muslim Brotherhood. There are people that want to basically engage a lot more with other pluralistic type of values, and there are people that they just want to reach out to other parts of the world.
But would you acknowledge that, which I think is part of what the caller is getting to, and it may be part of this misperception that you think many Americans might have, is that can you acknowledge that there may be an element of Muslim that is very, very extreme? And whether we want to say they've hijacked the religion, they've certainly manifested their extreme view of Muslim, and they have used it in a way that is devastating to at least the image of the religion worldwide.
Absolutely. I mean, okay. that's an indisputable fact. Okay. However, I think it's very important to say that it's also the overwhelming majority of the Muslim world suffers from the consequences of these people's actions as well.
But the point that I would make to the caller from South Carolina is that just as there are extremists within all factors of religion, we must also put in context that once upon a time in the United States of America, there were people under the Christian flag, under the Ku Klux Klan, who went to church every single Sunday and believed in Jesus Christ, and they lynched black people, and they burned their homes down. They were extreme Christians that did not practice the true tenets of their faith. They hijacked Christianity for their own political hatred of people because of the color of their skin. And that was wrong in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s, and maybe even today in some elements of American Christianity, just as it is wrong for those to hijack Muslim and to get together and to conspire and to blow up planes and to fly into buildings. Both extreme. It happens in every religion. Back to calls. Jake, you're next. Go ahead.
Bruce, wonderful word, hijack.
Thanks for calling.
That's my concern. I'm not worried, you know. Democracy and liberty are in the eyes of the beholder or the gatekeeper. Our founding fathers were Christian. They constructed a constitution and a bill of rights based upon our religious beliefs. The Middle East is Muslim. As long as the basic covenants of humanity followed in the constitution, even such like Turkey, I don't think many Americans would have a problem with that. Here's my problem. Hijack. Good word. Who is the opposition? My problem is you have a bunch of kids whose IQ could boil a swimming pool, who overthrew a sitting government, and foreign policy, the instrument of foreign policy, is not a video game. There are ramifications. The opposition is as fractured, caught off with guard, as the government of Egypt has been, as well as the United States government. And I feel that.
Jake, do me a favor. We're going to break. Stay on the line because I want to let everybody respond, and I want to. I liked your point. The IQ of a swimming pool. Did you say? I want to follow up on that and put that into context to at least an earlier description of at least the core of that movement, which we had earlier in the broadcast. But we'll come back to talk about that comment in a few moments. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and we're picking up. Jake, are you still on the line? Jake, are you still there?
I am.
Okay, we're going to respond because you made a comment about the IQ of the masses that you're seeing in the streets, and I know Yasser wanted to comment on that.
Let me qualify that.
Okay.
Because I'm not going to make, let's make a distinction between poverty and intelligence. Just because a person's poor doesn't mean they're not intelligent.
Right.
And my problem here is we have a young set of people, okay? Numbers vary. 500,000, 4 million. Let's call it less than 5% of the entire Egyptian population that was protesting. And my biggest problem here is you don't overthrow governments without a plan. The opposition doesn't have a plan. The government of Egypt doesn't have a plan. We certainly don't have a plan. And so you do what now?
Let's let Yasser respond.
So we just let the dictatorship basically go on forever for a lack of a plan. I mean, I personally disagree with that. But to just go back, I think that for you to characterize, I think this is a more kind of a bigger problem, I think, of our perception in the United States and the West of the Muslim world and Arabs in the Middle East. There's this constant effort in caricaturing basically these movements and these basically these young men and women that have basically been organizing millions upon millions of people to go on the streets and over and topple and do something that has been seen have been thought to be absolutely impossible. And by the way, just to kind of correct some facts, it's actually about 10 million people that were in the streets of Egypt. 4 million were in Cairo. The total population of Egypt is 80 million, so that's like 1/8 of the million of Egyptian population. If you think that organizing 10 million people, 1/8 of one of the countries, one of the world's biggest countries, is a feat of basically low IQ people, then I guess you're going to have to answer to that yourself. I'm not, you know.
Quick response to you, and then we're going to move on. Go ahead, Jake.
I'm not downplaying people's intelligence or poverty. What I'm saying to you, who threw out a 10 million figure to me, where did that figure come from? I didn't hear the press say that. I haven't heard anybody give up an accurate number. There have been wild numbers thrown all over. My problem is this. We have three sides, and I'm not saying dictatorship is good for anybody. I'm glad Hosni Mubarak is gone. I'm glad he's gone. That's not the issue. The issue is we now have a crisis on our hands. We have three entities without a plan.
Jake, if I may, I think this would probably quell your concern. I think it really depends on you probably would want to start diversifying your intake of information. Maybe you should switch off some of the TV channels or some of the radio stations that you're or internet sources that you're reading, and maybe just diversify a little bit more. Maybe go to the global media. There's a lot of really good things that are good resources that are basically reporting on what's happening to the last moment right now. We know that there are plans, that there are councils that are being established, that these plans are very sophisticated, that there are a lot of proposals out there. There's a way to streamline these proposals. People are discussing them. They involve many, many people that are very, very competent from all sorts of different sectors in the Egyptian society. This 10 million figure, by the way, comes from media channels that are in the region, that are on the ground. So I would just suggest to you and other callers to maybe diversify your intake of information a little bit more.
Thanks very much for your call. We've got less than 5 minutes left. Sharif, what's next? When you were on this program 2 weeks ago, you laid it out in a three-minute response. You basically predicted everything that has happened. So my question to you is, as sitting around the table here in the United States, what is the next country in that region to see monumental upheaval?
Algeria.
Why?
First of all, they're in more or less the same population situation as Egypt. Many years of dictatorship, repression, imprisonment, arbitrary arrest and detention. They went through a civil war in which an estimated 100,000 people were killed. There's a high level of economic underdevelopment and poverty. People are fed up. The Algerians are a very, very tough people, much tougher than the Egyptians. Egyptians are fun-loving people. When the Algerians, go to the streets, believe me, there's a lot of bloodshed that falls out of it. So Algeria is the area of concern.
Are we talking weeks, months?
Months is more likely, but nobody knows because it can take just a small unexpected spark to get it all started.
Although my prediction on that, if I may, just really quickly, sure. is I think it's going to be a lot more peaceful than you might think it is. I mean, I know that the history of Algeria points to...
But it all depends how much the government reacts to it.
I disagree with Yasser, and it's going to be for an ironic reason. Ironically, the importance of Egypt put it under the sort of global eye, and Mubarak was put in check and the way he could employ repression because the whole world was watching. Algeria, although it's wealthy, a beautiful country, an important country in the Arab world, does not have the same sort of...
And nobody's watching.
Nobody's watching. So I think it'll actually be more violent.
Going back to what you said in the response to one of the first questions on the broadcast this evening, Mubarak is gone. He's out of the picture. Is he really gone? I need a 30-second answer.
Not totally gone. I'm pretty sure that from his house in the Sinai, he's talking to General Tantawi. General Tantawi is the head of the military group. There's now going to be a 25-member civilian commission to be the equivalent of the collective presidency. There's also going to be a 50-member group of people who are going to represent the people. The political process is ongoing.
We should also mention, by the way, on February 19th, that's coming up next week, some of the opposition leaders in Algeria are calling for people to head to the streets. That's on the 19th of February. Perhaps we'll talk about it next week. Sharif Bassioni, thank you very much. Laith Al-Sud, thank you very much. Yasser Tabero, thank you very much. And then, again, another great 2 hours of discussion. We appreciate your insights into what's happening in Egypt. On that note, we say farewell to you. This program is a Genevieve production, produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Jason Scherer and Patrick Johnson help make this program possible. Until next week at the same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.